Kiss Army Nation, welcome to your podcast. This show is about you, your passion, and your experiences. Join us for panel discussions, interviews, fan profiles, and so much more. When the curtain drops, the excitement begins. So let's go. Hello, my friends, and welcome to episode 104 of the Kiss Army Nation podcast. I'm Pasquale Vary, one of your hosts.
And I am Claudius Perra. Welcome to the show, everyone. Born in Minneapolis, our guest tonight is an extremely talented musician, singer, songwriter, and record producer. He is best known as guitarist and frontman of the rock band Flip, as well as guitarist for the alternative rock band Zen from Mars. With an impressive and successful career in the glam, punk, and mainly rock world since the early 80s, he has an interesting connection with the Kiss circle, given his business relationship with the late Bill O'Coink. We are really honored to explore his past, present, and future projects. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Bryn Ahrens. Welcome to the show, Bryn.
Welcome. Claudio mentioned in the opener some of the bands you were and still are involved in, you know, playing guitar, singing, writing songs. But before we get into more detail of all of your past and present projects, how exactly did you get into music?
But a real starting point for me was folk guitar church masses, which was then called folk guitar, not acoustic guitar or unplugged, in about 1967. My dad then got a really cheap Silvertone acoustic guitar that was made out of a stuff that wasn't quite wood, but it was a bit more than cardboard. Mm-hmm. Somewhere between cardboard and wood, and the edges came over, and it was called a Stella Harmony. That's what it was, a Stella Harmony. And I started playing on that, sitting up on the steps in our house, away from everybody. And before I knew it, in the fifth grade, the music guy with me and two other kids, he saw us playing guitars and we had the basic cowboy chords down. The ever popular, I don't know how this will come across, often it comes across so garbly, which is so strange to me, but just the basic cowboy chords. And he heard us playing these, and he asked us to play in front of the whole school, three songs.
Okay.
Me and two other guys, Pat Calise and John Jordan. And one of us had a banjo, one had a ukulele, and one had an acoustic guitar. We did three different songs. We each sang one. They were Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road, Leaving on a Jet Plane, and A Boy Named Sue. And let me remind you, at this time, the song Leaving on a Jet Plane was a brand new song.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And that was really my very first performance. I want to say that was, I was told that was 1972 the other day. I'm not so good with dates, but I was telling somebody the story and they kind of did the math and they went, that'd be 1972.
Right.
So, but like fifth grade. And from there, I started a band in the seventh grade. It's so funny to use those as markers. In seventh grade, that band started out as Ash of Evil, then turned into Evil Ash, and then turned into Ash, and then turned into Pearl. And that band lasted from the sixth grade until we graduated high school.
Oh, wow.
That's a long time for four guys to do it. So we played every, you know, school type function there is to play within our little tiny neighborhood of North St. Paul and, you know, neighboring Woodbury, insert town name here, you know, mm-hmm. all the surrounding areas. We played every one of their schools. And back in the 70s, you'd play the big gymnasium with the really tall stage. And a lot of times they had theater lighting and you'd call your buddy up, you know, that, who had an extensive lighting rig at his house. Like, dude, you have dimmers on your walls at home, man. Will you be our light man? And then he'd come and run the lights. And that was really and we would build our own lighting boxes out of plywood and, you know, make our own giant speaker cabinets and play Tisco guitars and Montgomery Ward's amplifiers. We had used dry ice, but and that band, our very first performance, okay? Bless his soul, Kerry Dombrock, the original drummer, is no longer with us. His sister sent me the drum head.
Oh wow.
From 1972, right, from that concert. And Kerry had written on the back.
Oh, my God.
And it's, I don't know if you'll be able to catch it at all because it's kind of fading. Oh, yeah, you can see
it. Yeah, a little bit.
We see the date there. Okay.
It's like, and it's like little kid writing, right?
Right.
So it says March 1st. Oh, I got the date wrong. 1975, our first concert. I was playing my own drums. We had played Hook on the Water, Highway Star, School's Out, which is a really cool story, and two songs Bryn wrote, Freedom and Young Girl.
What a nice piece you have in there. Oh my God.
That's a heck of a memory.
So the teacher, the school teacher guy, John Stangle, let the whole school out 30 minutes early to come see us play in the gymnasium. There's photos of it on my Facebook and on the Rocksteady Records site. We had fog machines made out of little humidifiers and the whole bit, man, super cool. We had a pillow fight at the end. I realized that if he's going to give us the last half hour of the day at 3 o'clock when school ends, a bell will ring. And we were going to play School's Out.
Nice.
Why wouldn't we conceptualize and close the night out with School's Out? And by the time we get there, the actual school bell will ring and we'll be fucking cool.
Nice.
Right? Well, it'll be easier for us to find homecoming dates. Well, needless to say, we were so excited that day. Our parents all let us off of school. We went to the local Tom Thumb, and to be cool, we bought chewing tobacco, and not being aware, we swallowed it. We all got sick and threw up, made it to the show, put on a great freaking show, but we didn't realize in timing the set out with the school bell that we would be so excited that we would play all the songs two times too fast.
Right.
We had to vamp on the end of School's Out for like a week. You know, summer vacation. So that, you know, that would be an extended answer to how I got started in the music business. But I think it's a pretty cool story.
It really is. So, you know, talking about your early career in music, what is one of your like favorite memories of the time?
Well, that concert certainly. At Cowan School, playing Woodstock 98.
Oh, wow.
We were the first, Flip was the first national band on the huge main stage in 98. That's hard to forget. I do remember when my first real band, when we were old enough to start playing bars, was a band called Obsession.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And when we started selling out, once I asked if we could do two shows, and they said yes, we did all ages during the day, and then this was a new thing in 1983, 84, new concept, you know?
That was around the same time as Fan House, because you also had a band, right, under the name of Fan House?
This would be before Funhouse. Obsession did become Funhouse.
Oh, okay.
Which is a wonderful story. I don't mean to go off script.
Oh, go for it.
It's a wonderful story, which includes Mick Ronson, of David Bowie fame, who I did some work with, and he was life changing for me. And there's a nice story to be had there.
Go for it. Go, go, go.
But back to Obsession, they let us play two nights and we sold it out twice in one day. And I remember after that day, walking down the stairs from the band house where the lighting guy lived and the bass player lived and, you know, the sound guy lived and all the gear was stored and all that kind of thing. And the sun was shining on the steps as I was walking down. And I remember very distinctly, it was one of those moments that, why do I remember this moment over so many others? Why does this have an extra little to it? And this is one of those. And that was a really satisfying day for me. That was like, I was probably 21, 22 years old. I had really already dedicated myself since the sixth grade. I had to quit all after school sports, and I loved playing baseball. I was good at baseball, liked playing football. I was good enough at football, but to do band stuff. So to sell out two nights at 21, 22 years old, you're like, I think we can be confident in the decisions we've made thus far, and it's enough to put more gas in the tank, as it were. Mm-hmm. And push this thing. And that's kind of, you know, that my head has been in that game since Three Dog Night, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I've been around for a long time. I've been doing it for a long time. I lived in New York City for a long time, where I did studio guitar work for Sean Lennon, Buddy Miles. I was asked to join many popular bands. I've gotten to work with Jack Douglas as a record producer, Eddie Kramer, Kiss alumni, Eddie Kramer.
Yeah.
Well, we'll touch on that, later on. But Brent, so let me just fast forward to the 90s, specifically in 1993. I know that you were hired by RCA Records to write songs with Stephen Sherrill. Okay.
Yeah.
So awesome. How did you end up doing most of the work for those recordings? Because from what I read and what I heard, basically you took the lead and you wrote all the music and you did all the singing. So how did that happen?
Well, it really came from a guy named Peter Robinson at RCA Records, is where it started, who was coming out to see my New York City band called Rattlin' Bones a lot. And he actually asked me at one point to join the Dave Matthews Band. Because Dave Matthews at that time, they wanted like a showboat in the band. They wanted an added strong visual element to the group, which they thought it was lacking at the time. And anyway, during that time period, Peter and I became really good friends. He had come down and watch Rattlin' Bones at the Bitter End, all CBGBs, all the classic New York venues, China Club. Stephen Chereau's band, Kick Tracy, was on RCA Records. And at that time, the feeling at the label was that Kick Tracy, there was internal problems. But they wanted to exercise, they still liked Stephen, and they wanted to exercise the first right of refusal on Stephen. Mm-hmm. But in order to do that, they need somebody to write songs and put a band together for Stephen. Peter Robinson from RCA suggested me to Stephen, and Stephen was already very aware of me, because Stephen is also, we grew up 20 miles away from each other. Mm-hmm. So he was totally aware of all the work I had done up until that point. And he went, Bryn Arns, are you kidding? Yes. So we made some killer, killer, killer stuff under the band name Heavy Syrup.
Okay.
Alter Ego. Sensational. Electric Asylum, freaking awesome. Wind Chimes and Butterflies, fucking awesome. Fruit Smoothie, we do a cool version of Love Gun by Kiss, really slow. And during that sessions, Stephen and I did, I don't know, 25 songs, and some of them didn't get finished. And I was not going to, it would have behooved me to not, it would have not been good to show up in New York with unfinished works. So there was a couple things that I'll just sing them. We were going to do this weird version of My Generation that I wanted, like, what would it sound like if Sonic Youth or Tom Petty did My Generation?
Okay.
Right? And that's what we have. And it's stoner rock, and I'm really proud of it. Video was number two independent video that year, 93, 94, maybe 95. In Canada, number two, or number one in Canada, number one in Mexico, number two in the U.S. independent music video.
Brent, let me just get you there. So there's an awesome anecdote on that video, okay, of the cover of the Who's My Generation. So can you share with us and the audience, because I think it's fantastic story.
It's a wonderful story, and it's none of it is premeditated. It's all happenstance from the hip on the fly. Steven doesn't finish the song. One of them is My Generation. During that exact same time, my two good friends, Kilo Bale and Sherry Forever, a.k.a. Eric Bretto and Greg Item, were now playing in Badfinger. If you want it, here it is, come and get it. Right? They're now in Badfinger. And Greg was in Cherry Forever, was in Rattlin' Bones, was in Funhouse, was in Obsession. Him and I had played together since 1980. So when I was doing the demos for Steven, who had I asked to do it but the studio owner, Kilo, a.k.a. Eric Brettel, and Greg Item, my bass player I played with through forever, who moved back to Minneapolis from New York much earlier than I did. So during this time period, we're doing the demos together. Steven doesn't finish My Generation. I put a quickie vocal on it in one take. I didn't even know what I was going to do. Changed some lyrics on the fly. Got done with it. That day, a friend of mine who owned a big production lighting company had just purchased a bunch of lights and wanted to videotape something. Bryn, do you have anything I can videotape? Well, we're at Kilo Bale's, Eric Brettel's giant studio called the Sound Gallery, downtown Minneapolis. So we go, sure. And Kilo goes, and Eric says, yeah, we can do it. And so during that time where he's bringing his lights in and stuff, there's a guy when I grew up, Back to Ash of Evil, during that exact same time period as the Drumhead, had a band called Backbreaker.
Okay.
I always thought it was a pretty freaking cool band name. And I was freaking seventh, eighth grade. Anyway, I saw them play once, and he painted his face half black, half white.
Uh-huh.
So for the My Generation video, as a lark, there was a theater. I was downtown Minneapolis, big theater district, theater makeup store just a few blocks away. So I walked and got some, did the black and white makeup. We did My Generation, and I brought it back to New York with me and played it for my friends, Jack Douglas, my then manager, David Krebs, some guys in the New York Dolls, and some guys with Ace Frehley, and they lost their minds on it. And now I'll stop and see if there's another question. But that was the beginnings of the My Generation, how it came to be.
So big, so huge.
It's really cool. There's a couple. It's so homespun. It's so Little Rascals. If you watch the video, and I encourage people to do it, after this many years, I can fondly say I'm proud of it. If you watch the opening thing, the bass player is like really close, and he pulls back right at the beginning. That's because he had to hit record.
I love it.
So it was his tape machine. He would hit record and then back off, and then I would just walk in slowly. We duct taped the wide angle lens is a peekaboo from a standard thing from a door that we unscrewed and took out and duct taped onto the camera lens.
Holy moly.
Oh, wow.
And eventually it ends up on MTV.
There you go.
Nice. So is it safe to assume that it was that video in particular that allowed you to be signed to Hollywood Records?
Yes, I would say yes.
Okay.
That coupled with great live performances, because they came out and saw the band, and Flip has never played a bad show in our whole career.
Mm-hmm.
Never happened.
Now, tell us a little bit about Flip. How was Flip formed?
From that very, Flip was formed because the video got such a strong reaction that I was basically put in the position of putting that band together.
Okay.
So I called Kilo and Cherry and said, you guys, then this is post-MTV, which is a great story, as you may or may not know. I snuck it into MTV. And once that started getting played, I started getting calls from record companies. And I said, you guys, we should put a band together.
Mm-hmm.
I'll come back to Minneapolis to do it. And I flew back and forth a lot.
No, that's really cool, because it sounds like it's a whole series of events that led to the formation of Flip.
It absolutely is. And what's bizarre is, of course, to me, having been doing this sort of thing for so long, the things that happen along the way that excel these things are modus operandi. The significance of any given moment doesn't show itself right at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You don't know for a while what's good and what isn't. It's like, it's hard to dictate, at least it is for me, in real time. And I can't premeditate anything. I'm a 1 foot in front of the other guy. I can't walk mm-hmm. 2 steps in front of my next step. I can't do it.
Right.
Build it and they will come is my thing. And I think that's a healthy artistic way to be. And Bill O'Coin, confirmed this to me near the end, how proud of the art, how I just never let up. I'm doing 5 things at once, and every one of them's in an artistic venture, and how he just really admired that. And so that being said, my daily routine is just doing that. So I don't notice what's going to pop and what isn't necessarily. Mm-hmm. I do it all. You plant all the seeds, you fertilize them all, but somehow not all of them get sun or something.
Yeah.
You mentioned that your plan for Flip wasn't premeditated, but while you were forming the band, did you get the impression that, you know what, this is going to be something special?
Yes.
Yeah.
The short answer is yes. And we had a mantra that served us really well at that time. And so many bands get together, ours included, of course, and they say this line at band rehearsal. Wouldn't it be cool if?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we went, let's finish that sentence every time. Wouldn't it be cool if that guy who offered us the helicopter and the guy who offered us the cereal, we put them together and they dropped cereal on a crowd while we were playing. Let's do it. Yes.
That's crazy.
What if on Good Friday, instead of amp heads on top of the cabinets, well, and along with the amp heads on top of them, we line up microwave ovens and Chia hands out hot dogs to the audience as a gateway to the devil.
Oh, my God.
That's a nice way to finish in the what if questions, man. That's awesome.
Totally.
Oh my goodness.
Pillow fights, breakfast cereal. I mean, breakfast cereal, I really went crazy on, trying to conceptualize everything we can do with the breakfast cereal, to the point where Chia Karaoke, Kai Arnes, the great artist, my brother, was a multi-instrumentalist. And that worked well for us because we could invent instruments like the box of cereal as a shaker. And he started to get into a thing where he started to pour it into his mouth and eat it to a rhythm, like
right.
A little more, and he got really turned it into something really cool. And then he would spray the crowd with it. It really worked well.
No, that sounds like an amazing time and something very visual and theatrical about the show. But let's talk a little bit about the music. Tell us about the first debut album.
Well, we made it twice. The first time was right at the very tail end of the grunge era. We were brought to Seattle to work with the producer, Conrad Uno, and Scott McCoy, who had just done the Presidents of the United States of America. You remember that song, Lump? He's lump, he's in my head. And we had a touch of that quirky sense to us, so I can see that from their standpoint. You know, right. We have a song called Hairdo that is very, you know, I don't think you got it, but your hairdo, you know, and it's really quirky and, you know, sounds like a crank up toy or something. And anyway, that record did not work out. That pairing did not work out at all. I met some wonderful people there that I still am in contact with to this day. Mike McCready from Pearl Jam being one of them. Brad Sinsel from TKO and the War Babies. Freaking mega awesome. One of the best rock singers to ever walk the planet, hands down, and you'll never find anybody to argue with me. So I really cherished that, so the record went ill-fated and we recorded the whole thing. And kindly, the record label, Bob Pfeiffer, believed in me so much in the band that he gave us funding to re-record the whole record with Julian Raymond, who was a huge producer. I mean, he's produced the last four Cheap Trick records. He, you know, produced the Glenn Campbell documentary. He produced so many wonderful things, soundtracks for The Crow with me, tons of different things we've done together.
You took the same songs and you re-recorded the album?
No, then we went back to A&M with Julian, who we had previously recorded with before we went to Seattle, where we recorded something crazy like 32 songs in 2 days at A&M Studios.
Wow. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. And so we just said, can we just, and I liked how that shit sounded. And I really liked the engineer, Phil Caffell, who was very renowned. He had done Hotel California for the Eagles, just tons of fantastic work. Cheap Trick, Lap of Luxury, which was a fairly recent album. Well, not, you know, recent enough for me. And that went really well. So we please just do the whole record with Julian. And Julian came to Minneapolis. We did a bunch of pre-production work. He did some great arrangement tweaks on the music. We went to A&M Recording. They brought in the Los Angeles Philharmonic to play on All in My Head and Schizo Boy. The song sounded fucking great. The record label was 100% behind us. And then, the week after I Wish I Was a Planet, went to radio and started getting played literally within the first week. The Walt Disney changed all the employees at the record company.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And literally with that, the band goes to, because you're tied specifically to a person that works at the record company, you know. And new people were coming into a record company. Chances are that they are bringing also with them a band or three.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they're being brought into the label. And it was a fantastic time. I spent a lot of time at the Walt Disney Commissary eating lunch, sitting at a table where Julie Garland probably once sat and ate potato salad. And I lived on that. I was there a lot. Bob Pfeiffer believed in us so much. There was talk of there being a flip cartoon on Saturday mornings, almost like a punk rock Monkees cartoon. And I just thought that was fantastic. And I had just great support from Bob Pfeiffer. It's too bad that the, you know, business infrastructure of the company is what fell apart. It had nothing to do with the artistic temperament or quality of the people who worked there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe unfortunate times. And Bryn, after you guys released your debut album, of course, you know, there was a tour that followed. And who did you find yourself doing shows with? Because I read somewhere that you were sharing the stage with, everybody. Huh?
Let's name one. But it's the notables, I think, are pretty badass, like the Ramones, mm-hmm. the Super Suckers, Green Day, Stone Temple Pilots, Evanescence.
There's a really Evanescence too. Wow. There's
a really good Evanescence story where the road manager punched my road manager in the back of the head.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know if you call it a good story, but it's a real story. It's a real... real life thing. I don't know if you've seen the new Flip album. It's called Too Dumb to Quit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And around the outside of the album, it's a game board or a bunch of tiles. So if you spin and you move your thing on these tiles, every one of those things, of those tiles, move back three spaces, bus goes in the ditch. I mean, lighting falls on Bryn, cancel concert. All the things that are listed are real.
Oh, wow.
Every one of them actually happened. Yeah, those were the notables. Cheap Trick was the best. Mm. Cheap Trick was the absolute best. You know, but once again, we're on tour playing with this band and that band. You know, Lit, we were doing shows with. And then ending up in Woodstock was pretty 98 was pretty sensational towards the, pretty much the band peaked out probably a year and a half after that.
Okay.
Where it was just happening all the time. We were number one in 8 cities, and those cities, I couldn't list them all 100% correct, but we're like Worcester, Massachusetts, going to Fresno, California, to Austin, Texas, to, what was the name of the town in Michigan? We're number one in Michigan.
Detroit. And
Kansas City in the middle. And so we're like hop, skipping, and jumping all over.
All over the planet.
Yeah, like, let's see how far we can get them to go.
That was, yeah.
You think they'll go this far?
Yes, they will.
What would be the farthest place they could go from here?
So, Bryn, I want to talk a little bit about Bill O'Coin, because we mentioned that Flip was managed by Bill.
Yeah, this goes out to our friend Tom Feely.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Yes. Yeah, good shout out, for Tom. Absolutely.
This goes out to our good friend Bill.
The card, yeah. Oh, nice.
So awesome.
So awesome. Bill is, I ran with Bill probably longer than any other manager I've ever had, I almost think. 12 years we worked together pretty much solid. All okay. the time, on and off on other things, including a Broadway presentation of The Who's Quadrophenia.
Oh.
That I got Stephen Chereau hired on to play the lead.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So how did that eventual meeting happen between you and Bill?
Good question. My favorite manager I've ever had in the world, rest his soul, is Herb Gart. I have stories from here to. He was a guy that came out of the 1960 peace and demonstration music period in Washington Square Park in Manhattan. He is the man who coined the phrase and invented the phrase singer-songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
He has managed more great folk artists than I will bore you with a list of their names, as difficult as it is for me. Herb Gart, the great manager I just mentioned, who also, I have to say, frankly, managed a lot of the first rung writers and performers on the first Saturday Night Live.
Mm-hmm.
He was a comic genius. I saw him do funnier things than anybody in my whole life. We had switched from an obsession into Funhouse at this point.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Herb Gart, we went and made a trip to New York, and through our friend Buzzy Linhart, Herb Gart was notified about the band, came out and saw us at a place called Tramps in New York City. And he dug the show and became our manager. One of the first few things he did was hook us up with a guy named Mick Ronson to be the first band to record at Prince's Paisley Park Studios, if Mick liked the band, which he did, and he did produce the recordings, and they're fucking great. Mm-hmm. He did a great job. Herb Gart also wanted to improve on the live presentation of certain members of the band. So Herb Gart hired Bill LaCoyne to do this. And this is like 1986, 1987, perhaps, 87. And at we get done playing for the first time, and we're in a nice size warehouse. And we go into the front area, and I have a cigarette break, like I always do. And Bill goes, "Hey, Bryn, why aren't you fronting this band? You should be fronting this band. You should be the front guy." And I'm like, I never sang a note before, not even backups. Like, I was not prepared for this. We had a whiz kid guitar player who played all the kind of Van Halen right hand on the neck stuff. Jeff Lovin, he's phenomenal. I love him to this day. He's fucking awesome. So, but it was a different vibe. And Mick Ronson at that time really took a liking to my style of guitar playing, to the point, without sounding like a jackass, he said to me, when it was him and I and Ian Hunter sitting together, that I was the best natural guitar player he had ever seen. And Bill LaCoyne asked me why I wasn't fronting a band. So all of a sudden now I actually have confidence in my ability and the decisions and what it is that I see and like and want to encourage in my own performance, songwriting, and all of that. And if we go fast forward a little bit to the video and I get signed, one thing that stuck out in my mind as it pertains to hooking up with Bill LaCoyne is, oh my God, I'm doing exactly what Bill LaCoyne said I should have did 3 years ago.
What a vision, What a vision.
I have a manager at this time, but I think maybe Bill LaCoyne is the right manager. That clicked in my brain, and I called him, and he came right down, like within 2 weeks, spent a good 3-4 days with the band, and we shook hands on it, and he was in.
Wow. And Bryn, we talked about, you know, some of the shows that you guys did, you know, the energy and the theatricality that of Flip. But what would you say were the main accomplishments from Bill when he was managing Flip, you know, from if my memory serves me well, from 1998 to 2003. So what were the main accomplishments, you know, working with Bill?
Well, I have my favorite moments, and they are this: being gifted the Rocksteady Records company logo, use of the name. And one really great incident, and it's funny you ask this because I was telling somebody else this today, and this includes that Evanescence story of my road manager getting punched.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good.
We are now on Artemis Records, which is Columbia Records. Danny Goldberg and Daniel Glass are the president of the label. Bill LaCoyne got Danny Goldberg his first job in the music business working for Kiss. So we're on Columbia Records. It's us, Boston, the Pretenders, Warren Zevon, who had just passed, and Daniel Goldberg, the president, who loves Bill, and Bill loves him. And we do a record for them with Art Alexakis from Everclear, co-writing and co-producing it, him and I together. truth be told, he did most of the producing. Well, that's not totally true because I had recorded a bunch of the stuff before we ever got there, about 80% of it. So that being said, I don't know. We wrote a couple really cool songs together, and Artemis decides to put out a song called Freak.
Okay.
And it makes it to number 38. And a big part of that is in part to Daniel Goldberg and Billikoin's relationship. And so before it makes its climb all the way to 38, it's down in the 50s and 60s, and it looks like it's getting some traction. We get put on a tour with Evanescence, who at this time just had that big hit. And we do a big show, the whole bit. At the end of the show, I'm playing Back in Black. We do a pillow fight with three feather pillows, and feather pillows just make a beautiful mess. Beautiful. But this is something we've been doing every night for years, right? Our crew has vacuum cleaners and leaf blowers, and they know how to clean the stage perfectly.
Okay.
Perfectly. Is it still against the walls in the club and shit and the theaters and laying around? Yes. But anyway, we get done. The audience goes bananas for us. We're in St. Louis. Bananas. We went over like just perfectly. It was such a great show. The band was just on fire. We're walking back to the tour bus, Bill and I and the band. And our big road manager, Sean Walgren, all of a sudden goes, bam, goes down. And we turn around and Evanescence's road manager had cold cocked.
Oh.
Our road manager close fisted in the back of the head.
Holy moly.
We get onto the tour bus. We maintain that he's okay. And he, of course, is swearing up, vital, vital, vital. And we're all really concerned. During this period, we get a call from the booking agent who, for Evanescence, of course, who is now booking us on this tour. And I just got a call from the road manager. You guys are off the tour. Mm-hmm. And I know in my heart of hearts is because... Well, and the agent said, he goes, yeah, road manager says you're just not opening band material. You guys are headliners.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you were stealing the show.
They didn't want us on the tour, and that's why the guy punched my road manager in the back of the head and said it was about feathers, but it really wasn't. And to get to Billikoin, here's how he handled it. He's talking to the agent, who he knows, and he goes, yeah. And he's not saying a whole lot. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Well, you said you wanted a rock and roll band. Click. And hung up on the guy.
Nice.
And at this time, and then the back lounge of the tour bus, and it's just Bill and I. And he does that. You said you wanted a rock. You might have, you know, said, well, you said you wanted a fucking rock and roll band. Click, and that was it. And I just looked at him and went,
nice.
You're the man. That's right. Yes.
That guy was a legend. Man.
Good work. Good work. He always was encouraging me to do absolutely every idea I came up with, which there is no shortage of.
Now, speaking of that, You mentioned all the theatrical stunts you guys do on stage, and all the face paint, the smoking guitars, the pillow, the cereal. Now, is that something we mentioned premeditation before? Is that something that's premeditated? It's like, or is it something like, well, let's see what happens, and then is it part of the show, or is it just something that we'll see what it fair. Feels that's like at great, the time?
That's a great question. That's a fair assessment because not everything you do works over and over and over and over.
Exactly. That's right, why. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, for instance, we're playing a festival. I'm going to guess there's 18,000 people there. And we have mid-headlining status on the show. We pretend, and we hire a NSYNC, who was very popular at the time, look-alike band. And we have the radio station announce over the PA that we're stuck in traffic and we can't get there. But our good friends NSYNC are going to play in Flip's place. And they come out and they're boom, 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 and they got a track. They're all rehearsed. Nobody knows it's not them. And during this whole time, behind them is being erected a 20-foot flip box of cereal.
Oh, God.
20 foot high. That looks like this.
Okay.
Okay.
Jeez.
And it's made out of canvas. And it's just three-sided. And there's a slit down the middle of it. And there's a fog machine in the back of it. Right? So as they're performing, this thing's getting built. And all of a sudden, people start going, we want to flip. We come out and we have like sugared bottles. We're cracking bottles on their head. They have blood capsules. We kick the shit out of NSYNC and we bang and a little and kicking into our song. And the crowd's just like. So it was just another case of, you know, what if a band
right.
you know, couldn't make it? And NSYNC played at a rock festival in their place. And then the band showed up and like beat them up.
You made
okay,
it happen.
Let's do it. Here's what we need. And Kai, to my to his full on credit, my brother Kai pretty much manifested all these crazy ideas we would come up with. He would physically manifest the tools that the band had by being who the band was. And use those tools and companies and peoples and things to get all this stuff to actually be a reality.
Was that right? So, Brent, we wanted to ask you about you know the what happened during your performance at the 93X Fest in 2002 about the feathers and that was the pillow fight that you were mentioning before.
Well, no, during that particular gig we also dropped feathers.
Oh, okay.
From a helicopter.
Oh, my God.
Giant Tidy Whiteys for our second album. Really oversized one, which is titled Blow It Out Your Ass. With a flip Blow It Out Your Ass logo on them.
Oh, my goodness.
And we were threatened that if we did feather pillows, you know, there would be hell to pay.
Ah, okay.
They inspected our gear, and our road crew devised all these methods of hiding the feather pillows in amp cabinets and different things. And while we're playing, they're taking some of the amp cabinet backs off, and all of a sudden all the pillows appear. And it's just mayhem, and then a fucking helicopter flies over and drops. It doesn't suck.
I love it.
Oh, man. Safe to say, you guys are nuts. I love it.
You know, it's really a lot of fun. And one thing to remember is listen to the flip music, you know, I'm really proud of it. It's really great shit. And, you know, it's nothing more than any other band could do. There is time to do these things. They're doable. We did them. And it doesn't take away from all the time you need to make the music. Mm-hmm. So why more bands don't do more of the things they conceptualize when they're drinking the proverbial six pack at rehearsal and are making commentary about things. I wish, you know, I like it when these, it's pretty easy just to implement these things. They're not pretty easy, but it can be done. Just do it.
Do you guys like prepare for a show like this with, you know, offstage antics before the show and offstage antics after the show?
I never did. Off stage, pre-show or post-show antics. Actually, if I can be brought to the venue without completely sight unseen, 10 minutes before I go on stage and get handed a guitar and it's all working good and I didn't have to sound check it or anything.
Okay.
And then I will leave depending upon what's required. I find that if I spend as little time as possible at a particular gig, like roaming around the room, looking at things, playing guitar through the amp, if I do all that before the gig somehow loses some adrenaline magic.
Some energy.
Right.
Walk in cold and I've never seen the place before. And when I play a room, I'm not playing a shtick. It's not the same thing every time. I'm playing that moment in that room. So it's very possible I'll make reference to something that's, well, it's beyond possible. It will happen. I'll make multiple references to multiple things that are actually going on there and now. Mm-hmm. As opposed to like going during this part of this song, I will stand over here.
It's not planned.
That's interesting because I haven't heard many musicians that do that. Because what you're doing essentially is you're not preparing yourself before the show. You just go up there. It's like, let's just see what happens. And the adrenaline must be like, you must be fired up during the show.
We're very serious about the music. So there's musical rehearsals, of course, where we're probably more laid back and stuff. And, you know, there's a thing or two here you always want to work on or try a new idea or have a new song. So there's always rehearsals to be had. And frankly, we really like to play together, so we don't have a problem banging out 40 minutes to freaking 90 minutes of music if we start playing, because we like doing it that much. So, you know, in doing those things, we have that music it's just in us.
That's right. Bren, if my dates are correct, I think that you guys played your final show back in 2003, and then you reunited in 2016.
Good work.
So how did it feel to reunite? Get the band together again, and playing with the guys. How did it feel?
Phenomenal, because again, I don't like when people tell me what advance ticket sales are, so I never know.
Okay. Uh-huh. Interesting.
I didn't show up till 15 minutes before we play. I didn't know if there's going to be just three rows of people up against the front end of the stage or what. I had no idea. I walk in and I go, and it's packed in the gills. It's sold out.
Nice.
Go up, got 10 minutes. Say hi to everybody, poke a one hitter with Kilo, go up and do the show, and it's, when you have the chemistry right in anything you do, and this includes a band, you kind of float on it. So you no longer have to dictate what it is that it needs to do, like a good baseball team.
Yeah.
You're no longer dictating. You're going, you're listening to it, and it's telling you what to do, and you need to respond to that, not the other way around. And we're floating on it, and it just went fucking great. We sold out a huge show, and it went great. We played great, and it's documented. There's a Clone Me video, the opener out there. We had giant balloons that we kicked out. So yes, cereal was thrown all over the room at one point.
So you guys are still doing gigs once in a while. So
yes,
you're active.
We just put out a new album. Of course, COVID really put but we just did a bunch of East Coast dates with our friend Ace Frehley. And that went phenomenally. And our good friend Night Bob, really Night Bob's the man.
So Bren, you're a really busy guy, so you're also the founder of Bren Company, which is your own model of amplifiers, created from vintage radio consoles. Can you tell us more about that?
I sure can, and more products forthcoming. Bren Co, it's called.
Yeah, Bren Co.
And there's a video out in PremierGuitarMagazine.com on their thing that they made really cool. It shows my Bren Cos and explains really well their design and how great they are. Sitting on my mom's couch with the flu one day back in the early 70s when I could barely afford musical equipment, two things occurred to me. She had a really cool stand-up lamp with a round base. But that's a mic stand. And then she had a big Philco radio, and I looked over, I went at that Philco radio. Back then, you couldn't have big amps. They only made little amps. That's bigger than my amp. That could be an amplifier box. Well, years later, I put together this band called The Odd Fathers that's based during that era of those radios. I thought, wouldn't it be cool if our backline was just a bunch of old radios? And from there, getting a few of them, I started developing them and their qualities as far as speaker cabinets go. And trying different things with them and in them. Backs, no backs, this type of speaker, high wattage, low wattage, 10-inch, 12-inch, all the different configurations. And during this time period, Jack Douglas, the famed producer, was producing The Odd Fathers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's our friend Joe Perry with one of his Brinkos.
Look at that.
Yeah. Wow. You saw that, right? You can get a peek at that.
Yeah, we see it. Very cool.
Very cool. During that time, Jack Douglas, there's another Brinko, a really cool one.
Love it.
Nice.
Love it.
Yeah, really cool. And that's got like the 1962 vintage roll-up Regensen speaker in it. I send the photo of all these lined up, and I send it to Jack, and I go, Jack, look at these fucking amps. He just loved it. And he happens to be sitting with, at that moment in time, Alice Cooper, Johnny Depp, Joe Perry, I believe Paul McCartney, and a couple other guys. And he shows them all these, this picture of these amps. Like, well, my friend Bryn, these are all his. They all wanted one. Every one of them wanted one within 10 minutes. Jack called me right back. Can we get one to this person? Can we get one to that person? Can we get one to this person? Of course, I sent Jack's right away. And during that time, a good friend of mine, Dan Hansen, ran a great guitar store here called Groove City, saw them. And I started producing them exclusively for his music store.
Oh, okay.
Nice.
And so they're really cool. And some were just, you know, they're not all the same. They're all, you know, I really have to put in a good hunt for the right radio.
Exactly. The right
sonic qualities. And I like it aesthetically to be look really good. And as Taylor Swift and Joe Perry have both gotten, its word has gotten back to me, it's the only amp their other halves will let them keep in the living room.
Oh, that's beautiful. So Brent, so can you get parts, you know, with no issues there? So you have your
I found a network of people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Just, you know, you start when something like that pops, you just got to start hunting, right?
Exactly.
And you start hunting, and then I found a couple of people who really dig the idea. And, you know, will even contact me, you know. And I don't need all the electronics to necessarily work. So, you know, nothing past making sure the lights light up and the dials move the dial.
Exactly.
And they're not rattling.
Yeah.
You know, I can, they're like, yeah, this amp is past good. If you want, you know, you can get this really fucking mint condition radio at a lower price without the amplifier. I noticed a lot of people copied it after I did it, other guys. And I actually saw, like, on reverb.com one, somebody was selling one, and they were actually nice enough to say that it was inspired by the original Brinko.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
At least, yeah. So, Bryn, before we wrap up the show, we want to end with one final question. It's the way we usually end our interviews, with a little tribute to the Kiss Army. Now, you've contributed to a wide array of musical projects, and of course, you've come across fans from all walks of life. So in closing, how would you rate Kiss fans compared to the fans of your other musical projects that you've participated in?
Just a lot. In one word, fever, if that's how you pronounce that word correctly, fever. Kiss fans have an energy that is elevated. They care and care isn't the right word, because we care for a son or a daughter, and we care for our parents, and we, you know, it's not that kind of care. So it's like There's an elevated level of excitement when Kiss is involved. It's really that simple. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else to say. It's energy, isn't it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Passion. Mm-hmm.
In the end, it's energy. Yeah. And there's a lot of ingredients that go into that energy and some that we're not even aware of.
Bren, you know, we could keep going forever. This is so fascinating, but I know
thanks
that
for having me on.
You know, time is value for you, and you know, it was such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you very much, you know, for your kindness and making yourself available. It's been truly awesome to have you, and we can't thank you enough. Thank you so much.
Oh, you've thanked me more than enough. Thank you.
Well, a few more thank yous, because I also want to thank you. If we learned anything tonight about you, is that I don't believe you could have been where you are today if you weren't a risk taker. If you weren't the kind of person that thinks outside the box and let's try this. I don't care what other people think. I'm going to do this because I enjoy it and it feels right to me. I admire someone like that because it takes a lot of courage to do that. And you followed your dream because you're not afraid to take risks.
Learning to fail is really just part of it all, isn't it? It's all a matter of choosing where you want to fail.
Yeah, that's right. That's
I'd rather fail at this than a lot of other things.
Exactly.
And I'm too dumb to quit.
Well, you have an amazing career to show for it. So thanks again for being on the show.
There's plenty more coming. And again, you know, here's my shameless plug for the end of this. Check out the new iHeartRadio show. Right now it's titled Flip Sides. Mm-hmm. Check it out.
Super. Definitely. Super.
Bill, our good friend, I just did a show with our good friend and Ace Frehley and Gene Simmons alumni, Jeremy Asbrock.
Of course.
And I'll be doing Philip Schaus. I did Night Bob. Did a great interview with Night Bob that'll be coming out. Great one with the musical genius Charlie Barron. So yeah, there you have it. With that, I will stop.
No, that's it. It's part of the family. So we're close with Jeremy and Phil too. So beautiful. Awesome.
They're beautiful. They are beautiful people.
So to the Kiss Army, we hope you enjoy this episode. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas, please send them to talktome@kissarmynationpodcast.com. Until the next time, remember, never stop rocking. Take care, everyone. If you enjoyed this episode, like and subscribe on YouTube or follow us on Spotify, Podomatic, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Don't forget to make yourself heard. Leave us a comment on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. See you all soon, Kiss Army.